Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu.
With a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening. This morning comes from the Gospel of John, and this is the 12th chapter, verses 1 through 8. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, the home of Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. There they gave a dinner for Jesus. Martha served, and Lazarus was one of those at the table with him. Mary took a pound of costly perfume made of pure nard, anointed Jesus' feet, and wiped them with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, the one who was about to betray him, said, "Why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and the money given to the poor?" He said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. He kept the common purse and used to steal what was put into it. And Jesus said, "Leave her alone. She bought it so that she might keep it for the day of my burial. You always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me."
You say I love when I can't feel a thing. You say I'm strong when I think I'm weak. You say
poem by Mary Oliver. Let me keep my distance always from those who think they have the answers. Let me keep company always with those who say, "Look," and laugh in astonishment and bow their heads. For the last 2 days, Matt and I were graced to attend the fourth and turns out last Why Christian gathering. It was a gift from someone in the church who could not go, and they gave us their tickets, and we are grateful. If you've never heard of White Christian, it's a gathering that a few years ago, leaders Nadia Bolz-Weber and Rachel Held Evans created. And White Christian is a space that is provided in order to encourage and invite the public witness of progressive followers of Jesus. So I was surrounded, we were surrounded, mostly actually by women. There are a few men there. And that gathering of hundreds and hundreds of people at Grace Cathedral, which was so beautiful, brought their beautifully gender non-conforming LGBTQIA bodies and souls of ability and disability, of color and love, of humor and pain and shame, all of it to the table. As I said, we met at Grace Cathedral, which is a stunning house of worship. In the midst of this large, large crowd, in this expansive cathedral space, speaker after speaker simply stepped to the microphone and answered the question for themselves, why Christian? We feel that we will be unpacking what we experienced for quite some time. Nadia Bolz-Weber has answered that question for herself multiple times. And you can actually read her journey if you read her books. She seems to me right now to be on a journey of self-discovery that is continuing to uncover God's deep love for her. And right now, at 50, she is in a time of her life in which she is lifting up sexual shame for all of us to consider. Maybe you saw that last November she released her newest book. It's called Shameless. And in Shameless, Nadia takes on a specific aspect of sexual shame. It's known as the purity movement. It's not anything I had heard of or was familiar with. Purity movement goes something like this. It involves really an evangelical expression of Christianity in which usually a girl is given a ring. It's called her purity ring. And the idea is that you wear that ring to stay pure until you take it off and put on your wedding ring. And then, as I understand it, you put on that wedding ring at your wedding ceremony, and ta-da, you know absolutely everything there is to know about straight sex. And you have it fabulously with one person in the missionary position for the rest of your life. Seriously, this movement we learned more about has caused much damage and a great, great amount of shame. Shame does that, it damages us. And it makes us want to hide, to run away from our feelings. In the lead up to this book, Nadia tweeted. She's a prolific tweeter. Here is her tweet. I'm inviting women to mail in their purity rings to me and an artist. And we're going to have a massive art project. The artist is collaborating with me to melt all the purity rings into a sculpture of a giant vagina. She shared this with us yesterday. Just moments, she also said, after her tweet hit the Twitterverse, she received one back. It was from a man. It said this, actually, Nadia, shouldn't you take all of the melted purity, sell them, and give the money to the poor? You can check it. It's on Twitter. And then she told us, I answereth not. She's working on being compassionate with people. Me too. Like Nadia Bolz-Weber, Mary created quite a stir around the dining room table from those, as Mary Oliver penned it, those who think they have all the answers. She pours a whole pound of expensive ointment over Jesus' feet. The cost of 100 denarii works out to be about a whole year of wages for a manual laborer. So in today's currency, I said my math wrong. I have it from a helpful friend, not Matt. $11 an hour is what they would have been making. So in a whole year, after 8 hours a day for 300 days, that comes out to $22,880 worth of perfume poured out in one fell swoop. This led Judas to tweet to his community, "Actually, Mary, what a waste. You could have sold that oil and given the money to the poor." In the Gospel of Mark, it's a little different. We read, "They scolded her," without saying who they were. In the Gospel of Matthew, it says, "The disciples objected." By the time the Gospel of John was written, though, many years later, Judas is the one who makes the accusation. And we know what Judas turns out to be. Over and over again in Scripture, we are called to care for others, especially those who scrape for their existence on the margins, those who are outcast, those who live in poverty. Jesus himself turns over tables to call attention to the allocation of resources for those who are not at the top of our food chain. So Jesus' response to those who are calling Mary on her behavior caught them and maybe catches all of us off guard. He says, "Leave her alone. She bought it so that she might keep it for the day of my burial. You always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me." He doesn't shame her. He teaches. Because as a knowledgeable and practicing Jew, what we know is he was quoting from Deuteronomy. And in Deuteronomy 15, it says, "Give liberally and be ungrudging when you do so, for on this account the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in all that you undertake, since there will never cease to be some in need on earth. I therefore command you, open your hand to the poor and needy neighbor in your land." Those who think they have all the answers made Mary's action into a zero-sum game, an either-or. And that's because those who live in scarcity are prone to see the world that way. They can't help themselves. They see the bottom line, no matter where they look. Mary's jar of ointment set their mind to calculating the costs. "We could sell that and help so many people." Instead of opening their eyes and seeing a gift, when she broke open the jar, what they saw was a wasteful woman. They didn't see a generous giver. Scholar David Warbrick wrote about this passage. And he said, "There's a radical political aspect to an extravagant act like Mary's. While the world throws ugly at us, peddling fear and cynicism, Mary firmly asserts the overwhelming priority of relationship with Jesus. As she breaks the jar, she breaks the power of Rome over her heart and her mind." In the poetry of her composing, Lauren Daigle, I think, said that very same thing, but differently. When she said, "The only thing that matters now is everything you think of me. In you I find my worth. In you I find my identity. When I don't belong, God, you say, I am yours, and I believe what you say of me. I believe." Mary's not cautious. She's not careful. Mary is overflowing. Instead of using this moment for a future like strategy session, Mary calculates the cost of missing the relational opportunity right before her. Her gift begs the question, if not now, tell me when. She kneels at Jesus' feet and breaks open that jar. The aroma, I imagine it must have just filled the room. And then as everyone in the room watches, she does four more remarkable things right in a row. First, she lets down her hair in a room full of men. Women who concerned themselves with purity never did this. When she pours out the perfume onto Jesus' feet, this was only done for kings. And when it was done for kings, it would have been put on their head, never on their feet. Then Mary touches Jesus. A single woman rubbing a single man's feet. Not done. Not done, even among the closest of friends. And finally, having massaged the perfumed oil into the skin of his feet, she wipes off the excess that beads up with her hair so she can keep the scent of him with her always. She's free. And she's also freeing us, if we have the ears to hear. I don't want us to confuse this scene with the three others that are like it in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In Matthew and Mark, there is an unnamed woman who anoints Jesus' head in the house of Simon during the last week of Jesus' life. An unnamed woman. In Luke, the same scene is at Simon the Pharisee's house, but it's much earlier in Jesus' ministry, and Luke has Jesus eating a meal when a sinner slips into the room, and she stands weeping over his feet and then drops to the ground to kiss his feet before rubbing them with oil. Only John names her Mary. Only John lets us in on their relationship. She is not a stranger. Her love and care overflowed, and whether her judgment is unwise, I think, is actually hardly the point. Mary has shown attentiveness over the course of every day of their life and relationship. On tragic days, like when her brother Lazarus died, she was there. On regular days when they had to do the chores of everyday living. And now on this day, that suddenly at mealtime became special. She makes it even more so by sharing the costly perfume. And as it pours out, you also imagine just a whiff of death is surrounding them. But still, she holds nothing back. As one preacher wrote, her boundless expression of love for Jesus was beyond any calculations. Jesus accepted this extravagant gift, not because he asked for it or necessarily needed it. He received it as an expression of her deep devotion to him. And he seems grateful for their rich and deep relationship with each other. The way Nadia explained it to all of us yesterday went like this. Back then, Mary let down her hair. Today, she would have taken off her Spanx and let the muffin top overflow. right? Mary was that free woman. She had a sense that they may never, ever see this moment or this place in time again. After all, hadn't Jesus just stopped there on his way back to Jerusalem, where his life was known to be at risk from the religious and political leaders of his day? They all knew on some level that Jesus may not have long for this world. She was so grateful for him. Words were just not going to cut it. She had to find a way to show her love, and she wasn't the cook in the family. No homemade bread. She knew the gift to share, and to share generously. She knew right where she had stored it. It was a beautiful gift. It's used for so many things, sometimes pleasure, sometimes medicinal, sometimes at death to prepare the body. It's always safe there, tucked away when the family needs it. Grace upon grace, abundancy. This is what Mary teaches Jesus and everyone who watches in the room. She teaches the cost of discipleship. Back in 1950s, around here, there was a very small group of people who shared generously. And back in the 50s, they gave $45,000, which today would roughly equal about $380,000, to fund the blueprints for this property and to complete this beautiful sanctuary in which we sit today. That funding included the creation of custom stained glass windows created down in San Francisco and brought up here. And one thing we learned just recently, we keep learning more of the story from a woman who no longer lives in Sacramento, was a youth counselor here. She wanted to see if the window was still okay because she told us all of the people in the church in small groups made choices about each of the symbols, made choices about what words they wanted to worship under. They gave it to the artists with their color choices, and they all collaborated together. While several incredible, generous gifts have sustained this facility over the years since then, a very thoughtful campaign to restore and upgrade this facility has been deferred over and over again, thinking that maybe the cost would be just too much. But last summer, we began to wonder if we might just be ready to celebrate abundance by raising funds for restoration at the table. 115 of you responded to questions about our facility and shared hopes, your hopes, for our shared future together, making the outside landscape as beautiful as the inside of the sanctuary, making critical ADA upgrades, restoring and updating bathrooms. Women, can I get an amen on that? Amen. And so much more. Men, go on in there. Anyone, go see our bathroom. The one right here at the hall. Our administrative teams from last year and our single administrative board, which began in January, came together around all of these priorities and outlined them for us in phases. And we've come, we're happy to say, to the unanimous support for moving forward with plans for restoration at the table. One person on our administrative board stood with Mary and made for her family what equates to the most extravagant and faithful pledge of $2,500. The world would see her and her family's finances as scarce, Yet she chooses to live in abundance and generosity. A second family, their gift has already soaked the ground outside our sanctuary with a generous pledge of $100,000. We've just completed the conversations with our administrative board about gifts to this campaign that we're calling Restoration at the Table. And we'll be meeting with many more people in the coming weeks. All of you that want to, who participated in the feasibility study, and we're so hopeful that the abundance of those who have gone before us will be matched, met, and exceeded as we join them as passing on the gift of this place for our generation and for generations to come. Unfortunately, some people cast suspicions about a donor's reason for giving their gift. See, when you start going around not wearing Spanx and being all free and acting and living out of abundancy and freedom, many folks don't really know what to do with those kinds of actions of love. It's true. Some gifts can come with strings attached, as when someone uses their extravagance as a way to peddle influence. We saw this week in the news with the Sackler family. Their wealth, gained in no small part from the sale of opioids, was shared lavishly all over our country with museum and other arts organizations, which are often those organizations, some of the most hard-pressed for cash. But this week, the British National Portrait Gallery, in a bold move, chose not to move forward with the $1.3 million gift that they had been given from the Sacklers. But Mary, she didn't have any influence to peddle. She simply gave all she had. William Carter writes in a commentary about this. He says, "Even more controversial is the abundant gift with no restrictions. Not only will the gift spark debate over its use, but it may reveal the otherwise hidden priorities of those who make the decisions. A gift may provoke suspicion about people's motives. Others will complain that generosity skewers all of the prevailing complacency. A few may perceive that any criticism of generosity is a wonderful way to dodge its power." Mary's extravagance raised resentment in that room. And from that place, many will get in line behind Judas and make desperate claims about her gift as they seek to dodge the power it is evoking. They'll take to trolling on Twitter and they'll say, "Actually, Linda, shouldn't that gift you mentioned in worship, shouldn't they both better be spent on the poor?" Caroline Lewis wrote this week. "Isn't it just so interesting how Judas shows up in the middle of this display of abundant love? It's as if he just can't stand it. It's as if there is only so much love he can take. And I don't think," she says, "Judas is the only one feeling like that." Because this is what can happen when love flows abundantly. We think it untrue, that abundant love. We don't imagine ourselves worthy of it. And we allow ourselves our shame. And we let the shame talk louder than God. And while we're doing this, we also allow ourselves to think, a lot of us, that others don't deserve God's love either. We put boundaries around God's love. We say, I'm not enough, and neither are those people who behave like this, who look like this, who act like this, who live here. Control, contain, confine, that's what we try to do. But love always wins. Love always wins because love is of God. Look at Jesus in this story. He does not push Mary away. He receives her. He says, you always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me. He loves her. And this is a story about what love looks like. Jesus accepting fully who Mary is and what she has to bring. In silence, in intimate reception, and a posture and a message of mutuality. If not now, I think he's saying, tell me when. After all, we are coming to the end. Matt just reviewed a Holy Week schedule for us, right? Next week is Palm Sunday. In the very next chapter comes the story of foot washing, the farewell discourse, Jesus' final prayer, and then his arrest in the garden. If there is ever a time Jesus needs to know he is loved, it's here and it's now. And I wonder, filling in the blanks and filling in the gaps for myself, I think Jesus' gratitude for Mary's love likely matches the overpowering fragrance of the perfume that filled the room. So let's not wait to follow Mary's example. Let's not let the cost scare us or hold us back from sharing our gratitude and our love. Mary Oliver, again, she wrote these words, look. Look again. This world is not just a little thrill for the eyes. It's more than bones. It's more than the delicate wrist with its personal pulse. It's more than the beating of the single heart. It's praising. It's giving until the giving feels like receiving. I believe it feels in this room like we are receiving the gift of this space from those who gave before they knew us. Giving that feels like receiving. It takes a change of heart for these kinds of things to mend. But miracles, they do happen. Every shining now and then. So if not now, let's say it together. Tell me.
Sick God, well, your hand. Tell me what kind of man.